This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, in a reprise of a Halloween special from 4 years ago, we talk with a former police detective who not only claims to have seen Bigfoot twice, but who also helped supply evidence to prove the existence of the elusive creatures that most believe to be only a myth. And now, let's go inside the Compass. At the beginning of October, a group calling itself the Sasquatch Genome Project published the results of a five-year, half-million-dollar research project that purported to prove that the famously elusive creatures, also known as Bigfoot, that have been presumed by most to be a myth or a hoax, not only exist, but are in fact close relatives to humans. According to the results of the study, Sasquatch is descended from human females coupled with fathers from a previously unknown species of primate, curiously standing separate from the known fossil record and thus from known evolution. The research was conducted by a team of 10 scientists from 8 separate private and university laboratories under the direction of forensic geneticist Dr. Melba Ketchum, who is the director of DNA Diagnostics in Texas, a firm that does work ranging from animal genetics to criminal forensics. The study has come under fire from skeptics, who point to the fact that the study was essentially self-published without peer review. Dr. Ketchum has responded by saying that the work was in fact reviewed, but that the taboo nature of the subject matter led to refusals to publish in established journals. The study used 111 samples of saliva, hair, and tissue that were submitted to the researchers from some 34 collection sites throughout North America. One of those who submitted samples for the study was Quimper Peninsula resident Rich Germeau, a former policeman and detective who, after an encounter with what he believed to be a Bigfoot one evening while out on patrol in the West End more than a decade ago, eventually became obsessed with trying to capture one on film. Obtaining funding from a California millionaire, Germeau carefully placed motion and heat-sensing cameras in wilderness areas around the Olympic Peninsula. I drove out to the Double Wide on a dead-end road in Eagle Mount, where Germeau lives with his wife and two young daughters, one recent evening to talk with him about his experiences. Both Germeau and his wife, Sonia, are Olympic Peninsula natives, descendants of loggers. Rich Germeau is compact with short-cut dark hair and an intense direct gaze that challenges doubt. Nonetheless, I started the interview on a dubious note.
For a lot of us, it just seems too hard to believe because the wilderness is all but gone. So certainly in the summertime, like here in the Olympic National Park, it's crisscrossed by hikers. People are like climbing the mountains. Mm-hmm. They're just everywhere. And I mean, if there was this whole other species of hominid out there, there would be more evidence. We would have found a body by this time or something. I mean, you know, there would be proof.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, as far as that goes, and that's the camp that I was in growing up, you know, and like I said, I was interested in the unsolved mysteries and things like that just because I watched it. But, you know, I thought like everybody else, I was in the same group that there is absolutely no way something like that could be under our fingertip and just be out there. I mean, I spent my whole life as a kid growing up out in the woods here, everywhere in the West End and up around Quilicine and Penny Creek up there, and never saw anything, never looked for anything really.
Well, so tell me about the experience that changed your mind. I mean, what did you see?
Well, I was a cop, actually. I was working in La Push. It's out on the coast and on an Indian reservation, and I was heading out to work one day. It was in July, the year 2000, and it was in the evening, but it was still daylight. It was probably 7, 8 p.m.
time. Evening. That time of year when the sun goes down at 10 or 11.
Yeah, it was perfectly daylight. And I was coming down the road. I had crossed, and I was actually down in La Push. I was coming around the corner past housing, and I had just passed the parking lot for Second Beach, right down at Lonesome Creek, where it crosses the road. And there were actually people surfing and everything down there. It wasn't like there was nobody around. There were people out. And this thing just pops up out of the brush on the side of the road, and it just steps onto the road. And I'm no more than 70 yards. I'm probably somewhere between 50 and 70 yards from it. And I was definitely close enough during the daylight to get a pretty good look. It never looked at me, and I was just far enough away that I couldn't get any facial detail or fingers or anything like that. But it was clearly all one color. It was huge, you know, and it was all, it looked bushy like hair. Can I stop my car in the middle of the road when this thing went by? It probably lasted.
You're in your police
yeah,
car?
Yeah, I was in my patrol car. And it probably only took, the whole thing probably lasted a couple of seconds. I think it took about 4 steps and cleared the road, and it wasn't running. It was moving with a sense of purpose, but it wasn't running.
It was moving on 2 legs.
Yeah, I was walking on 2 legs like a human, but it had a gait that wasn't human. That was the thing that caught my attention. And there was a traffic sign down there, and I remember looking at that later, trying to get a gauge of the height, and I don't know how close that I was, but I figured it was somewhere around 8 feet tall. We're pretty well trained in observance and stuff and identification and whatnot, and I've always been kind of good at that. And
What was your reaction to seeing this, and how long did it take you before you decided to report? I mean, did you think about holding the information to yourself out of fear of, you know, like what people would think of you?
Well, first start out with, my reaction, I was anxiety probably initially, and my heart rate went up real fast because what I saw didn't make sense. It didn't fit into what my belief system or my reality was. It was like seeing something and trying to categorize it immediately. I kept trying to put it in the right box where it was supposed to be in my head, you know, and I kept replaying that and it didn't fit anywhere. I mean, it looked, could it be human is what ultimately went down to, but it was not wearing any clothes. It was all the same color and it was huge. It was way bigger proportionally than anybody I've ever seen. And I mean, the thing was that thick, 3.5 feet thick from its back to its chest. I mean, looking at it, at least that's what it appeared to be. I mean, it was massive in proportion. It kind of glided across the road. It was the gait wasn't human. It didn't, the head didn't bob on it at all. And the arm had a slight arm swing to it, but it was just different.
So it crossed the road and then you saw it going into the bush?
Yeah, it just went. It hit this straight along a fence. And there's a chain link fence with barbed wire on the top. And it hit that edge of that fence and it just followed the fence.
Did you try to follow it at all?
No, I was too scared. I wasn't going to go in the woods after any. I mean, I just stopped my car and tried to gather myself together. I drove right to my office, which was about a mile, not even a mile from there. And I walked in and I said, you guys will never guess what I just saw. And I told them and they laughed at me at first. And then there was a guy named Sergeant, was Kevin Martin. He was there. Rick Lester was an officer down there. He's dead now. And then Matt... he's still a deputy in Clallam County. Yeah. Anyways, he was there and he laughed at me and joked. But they told me later, Rick Lester and Matt, they had been on a four-wheeling trip up in the A Road, which is up off the Clallam River. And there was a bunch of cops, 5 or 6 of them. And they had all found like 2 sets of tracks in the roadway where they had parked their vehicles that were big. One real big set and then human-like bare footprints and then one smaller. And they had decided they weren't going to tell anybody about it because... it's just not something that you tell people about, especially if you're a cop. You know, people don't think the same about you generally after you mention that.
And did you find that was the case for you? I mean, once you started...
They laughed at me initially, and, you know, I'm not the kind of person that really worries about that kind of thing too much. I don't really care what other people think of me. Yeah, I got ridiculed. Every time I brought it up, people, they smile at you or they chuckle a little bit, and unless you're talking to somebody else that's had the same experience as you. And then they can kind of confide in you because they have somebody that they can actually talk to about it because... this is something that changes your belief system. It basically, you see a reality that's not supposed to exist, and it starts making you question a lot of other things too. You don't really have anybody to go to. You can't talk to anybody about it seriously. Especially imagine if you're in a position of authority or a professional type position, and a lot of people that are in those positions have seen these things. I mean, I think that there's some post-traumatic stress that goes along with this too. It's something that, it changes your behavior. I mean, it changed mine. I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in the woods by myself. I fished all over out there and used to hunt and stuff too and hike and alone, you know, off trail, just go out in the woods, mushroom pick, and it made me think twice about it. If you hunt and stuff like that, and us as human beings, especially as men, you think that we're the most intelligent, we're the apex predator, nothing else can match us really out there. And then when you change the equation completely and you realize that there's something that is human-like that's way bigger than you are and way stronger, can move way faster, can utilize its habitat and its surroundings, knows it by the back of its hand, and it lives there. And then we go into that environment that's foreign to us, basically. And you've got something that has an upper hand on you all the time. And does it have good intentions or bad? I don't know. I mean, we don't know anything about them.
Yeah. So then you actually had another experience later on. So when did that occur?
November 11, 2010. And I was out checking cameras at a location that we had.
So at this point, you were actively seeking Sasquatch.
Well, let me go back a little bit. It'll give people a little bit better perspective about it. Between 2000 and 2008, I never talked to a Bigfoot researcher ever up until that point. My wife had a friend. Our kids went to the same school, and she ended up telling them one day, topic of Bigfoot camp, that I had seen one. And this woman knew a guy in Belfair who was big into it, and his name was Derek Randles. And he had been involved in the Skookum cast. It was kind of a famous thing in the year 2000. And he called me up one night because she gave him my phone number. And Derek was kind of high up in this agency. And he was an investigator, and he talked to me over the phone. I told him what happened and how it impacted me and everything like that. And he tried to convince me to get involved in research with him and everything, and I wasn't interested in it because it was attractive for him to talk to me because of what I did for a living. I was a detective for that sheriff's office in Mason County, and I investigated, I was a general investigator. I did everything. I think he thought that I was pretty compelling as a witness because I was credible. And you don't run into that all the time, especially in this topic. You know, Joe Schmo, the redneck, or whoever else shooting their guns, or is out hunting, you know, sees one and tries to tell somebody, and they're not credible anyways, or for whatever reason. But then when you run into somebody who has a professional background, you know, and signs documents under the penalty of perjury, and they're telling you this stuff, and they're risking their career when they're telling you this stuff, it compels you a little bit more, and you listen a little bit harder. And so that's where he was at. And so he convinced me, you know, you could do some good in this and you got a lot of experience and whatnot. And I wasn't all that interested, but, you know, I came around and then the next year I went elk hunting. I think it was a couple months after I had first talked to him. And we had found a few things that were interesting out there, and nothing really significant. But it gave me some ideas about doing a camera trap project. If we could secure money to buy cameras, you know, along the ridgetops in the Olympic Mountains, because there was a lot of sightings historically throughout the Olympics. You know, I got to the idea that if there's very, very few of these things, if they're some ape or relic hominid or whatever that they are, if we could narrow down the window that we're looking, basically take the terrain and use it to our advantage. You know, you can really see where animals travel in there, and especially once you get into the, you know, ravines and the ridges and valleys and everything, because they leave game trails. Because the terrain dictates where they go. We figured that Bigfoot would probably be using these ridgetops, or at least be crossing over saddles to move from one drainage to another. And if you could narrow down these areas and figure out where they were at to try to get a good idea of the paths that they're using to travel. So that's what we did. I talked to him about it, and he thought it was a good idea. And he was already dealing with a guy named Wally Hursom down in California, who's a multimillionaire, and he was interested in the topic. And so Derek knew him, and he called him and pitched the idea to him, and he thought it was great, and he gave us some money and bought us a bunch of cameras, and we started putting them out. And one of the areas that I put a lot of stuff initially was up down in the Hama Hama. You know, there's historically a whole bunch of sightings down there over a long period of time from the 1950s until present. And we were able to, you know, pinpoint where these sightings were at based on, you know, some databases and whatnot. And when you look at the terrain and then you look at the locations, if there really is an animal out there, it's got to go somewhere to get from point A to point B. And that's what we were trying to figure out. We had some success. We had some photographs from the Hama Hama in 2009. And that,
I mean, from your cameras.
Yeah. It was a camera that I set up there off the area that I researched. And so we got these pictures. Myself and Brian Rasmussen went up and set the camera. We recovered it. Notice the camera had been moved slightly when we came back. And it was cable locked to a tree, but bears can do that or whatever else. It's not a big deal. And we went back and looked at the pictures. There was like 800 and some pictures. We set the camera on like July 11th and came back and like August 13th or 14th or something like that. And one came up to the camera. You know, it was at first, you know, it was hard to tell what it was. You know, it had, you know, you look at it and then you can kind of see it was kind of blurry out of focus like they all are. The photos aren't very compelling. You know, when you really see what you're looking at and you know, there isn't really a whole lot of question, but the subject that visited showed up on like July 25th. It was like at 4 a.m. The dates are on the pictures.
Do the cameras flash or are they infrared? I mean, can they
photograph? Yeah, they're infrared. But I think these things probably can see infrared. a lot of animals can see it. Deer see it. Cougars can see it. It doesn't bother them all that much, but you can definitely tell that they can see it the way they react in a lot of times, you know. And these are high-dollar cameras. I've got one here. I mean, these are the cameras that we were using. I mean, we had, this is the second generation. These are what mostly we had, but these are like $600 to $800 a piece.
So it's in a camouflaged case.
And it's covert, meaning you can't see the infrared lights come on. It's got some kind of technology where it's got a shield in front of it where the light can shine through, but you can't see the, and that, we thought that was important. I don't think it is so much, to be honest with you now, but.
Are these cameras still out in the woods? I mean,
is this an ongoing? Yeah, I still have some out. You know, I don't have as many as I have like 17 of these now. I'm not a member of the group anymore, and so we split a lot of the resources up, the cameras, and I kept about half of them or about a third. And I'm involved in another group now that's out of Colorado. I'm more of a consultant on basis. I don't go out and do as much trying to gather evidence or whatnot anymore as what I did before. I'm not really interested in that anymore. I think that we did it already. So now what I do more is I'm a consultant for a guy with this organization called North American Bigfoot Search, NABS. And
what are you doing professionally? I mean, is that your career now?
Or? No, I just do that as a hobby, more or less. But I work in Squim for a small company.
So you're no longer a police officer?
I don't do it. I lost that election. You know, when you run for sheriff against your boss and he wins, it's not usually a comfortable environment after that. So, you know, I worked there for about a year and a half afterwards, and then I was like threw in the towel. And moved out here.
So when did you have your second encounter?
It was 2010. It was after I ran for sheriff, actually, and I had just lost, and I was pulling campaign signs. Mm-hmm. And I was in the area of Hardstein Island and down in the South Puget Sound, mm-hmm. Case Inlet. And so I went out there to pull campaign signs, and I had my keys for my game cameras, and I figured I was in the area, and I hadn't been out there in a couple of weeks. I figured I'd stop by and check. I had some cameras close to the road. So it was really quiet when I went there, which is odd. And that has to do, sometimes that's a factor with these. You'll notice that you won't hear nothing. There are no other animals around. They leave, generally. So it's dead quiet, not even birds or frogs. It's really strange. And it was like that day. And I wasn't very comfortable with going in there for some reason. I kind of had something kept telling me, you probably should just go home. You probably shouldn't even go down here. And I did anyways. I didn't believe in that stuff. And so I just went anyhow. I walked in and I got a whole ring of keys because I had like 25 cameras I was taking care of. And I got to the first camera and I started going through my keys to unlock it. And right away, I heard something off to the right and it was barely drizzling. So I couldn't tell for sure right away if it was raindrops or it was twigs breaking, but it would just be sporadic, just a couple snap, snap, but real subtle. But I could hear it off to the northwest of me. And I'd stop and look up and I wouldn't see nothing there, but it sounded really close. I stopped probably about 8 or 9 times because I heard something. And finally, I heard this. I'm going to do it. And it sounds like a deer snort. And so I figured there's a lot of deer in this area. And I figured it was probably a buck that was going to come through because it was that time of the year. Anyways, I got mostly through the keys. And I was really unsettled at that point. I just wanted to get out of there. But I was thinking I was going to have to go through my keys again because I probably missed the one because I had so many keys. It happens all the time where you go through your ring, you don't get it, and you go through a second time, and boom. I got to the second to the last key, and it was the key. I unlocked it, and I had a really sense of dread for some reason. I can't explain why.
You are unarmed at this point, right?
I wasn't armed that time. I usually always am, but for this time, I didn't have a gun with me. And so I unlock it, and I pull the cover off the camera, and I get the card out, turn the camera off first, get the card out. And then I put a new card in, turn the camera on. You got to wait about 30 seconds for it to arm. Well, it was just about 10 seconds after I pushed that card in and turned it on, right in front of me, I heard exhale, and it was like, like that. And I knew right away what it was. I started to lift my head up, kind of what seemed slowly, because time started to slow down then. And, you know, I was wearing a hat, and on the brim of my hat, I could see something standing out there about 20 yards along this big maple. And as soon as I started to lift my head, it started to kind of duck down. So by the time I got my head up, it was not really ducked down. It kind of crunched over and it kind of moved across this opening, but super fast. I'm talking like, I can't even explain to you how it scared the hell out of me because of the speed. It was like 0 to 45 miles an hour that fast. And it was a blur, but the thing was huge. And I could see there was something stuck in its hair too on its back. And it was moving I was close. 20 yards, but it was moving too fast for me to see the detail in the face and everything. and it moved on. It was up on two legs, and it stayed on two legs, but it hunched over slightly, kind of lowered itself slightly, and just in one motion, it went from standing straight up to kind of down and shooting across this like 10-yard opening. And then I remember when I seen it, I was thinking to myself that it was flanking me because my car was parked about 75 yards up this way. And I thought to myself, there's no way I'm getting out of here if it wants me because I cannot, it moves way faster than I do. I walked to my car, drove home. I was white as a ghost when I got there. My wife asked me what was wrong, what happened. And I told her, and, you know, that's what happened. I almost quit doing the whole thing at that point just because I was scared to death. But I mean, I'm pretty sure there were two of them. Because we had found before when we were researching that site about a year and a half earlier, we'd found two different sets of tracks down there, one in the snow, and then we found some other single impressions down the other side of the road where I was at that day. And those were all 16 and a half inches long. And the ones that we found after my sighting were 14 and a half. And there's always more than one of these anyways. They never travel alone. They always travel in a family group generally.
So I want to ask you about the Sasquatch Genome Project, mm-hmm. because this is supposed to be the proof. We've gotten the DNA. Where did they get the samples? Saliva. How did you get saliva?
I swabbed it. I mean, I'm trained on how to, you know, collect forensic evidence. And I saw a smudge on this lens of that camera, and the pictures gave me the belief that it probably had its face close. It was probably worth to go back and swab it. So I went back a couple days later with the other guy, and he videotaped the whole time of me collecting all the evidence. I explained everything. I did it just like I would at a crime scene. And I had seen a smudge on the lens that looked like liquid had smudged on it. And so I swabbed the whole camera. I used distilled water, sterile swab. You know, I dipped the swab. I wear rubber gloves, latex gloves that are sterile. Dipped the swab in the distilled water, swabbed the whole camera with that. And then you package the swab in a container or back in the original package. And I used evidence tape and I taped it up, you know, after I sealed it. And I kept them until I found some place to send them, because it's not like you can just send those to somebody to check for DNA, because nobody believes it anyways. You're not going to find many labs that are going to do that for you. They're just going to try to prove that it's something else. I called Jeff Meldrum, and everybody who's seen anything on TV about Bigfoot knows who he is. He's the guy from Idaho State University. He's on all the documentaries and everything else. And he's a primatologist. He specializes in primate locomotion. So Jeff Meldrum referred me to Melba Ketchum. He wasn't involved in the study. Meldrum wasn't, but nobody else has really undertaken anything serious in this. A lot of presumptive Sasquatch DNA had been tested before, but it always comes back. They test mitochondrial DNA, which is female lineage. It's real easy DNA to test for species ID, and you don't need very much material to do it. And whenever they tested these things, they come back human right away. So they just knock it off to human contamination in the DNA. End of story. It's, you know, they don't ever go any further. But these scientists testing stuff don't generally know the background of the samples they're testing, and they don't meet the people in person. So they don't know the credibility of the people involved. So they immediately think that something was done incorrectly when they get these results. Because they certainly don't think that there's just wild human beings running around out there, right? You know, so the only way to get to the secret of this thing is to run nuclear DNA testing, because if you run mitochondrial DNA, you're just going to come up human on it, because these things share the same mother as we do. I mean, these things have a human mother. The scientific community does not think it's viable, or does not want to believe that there's basically a hybrid species.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of just open rejection of the findings, people who are like pointing out also this is not a peer reviewed article.
It was peer reviewed, and there's evidence of that. If you research a little more, she's got documentation of the peer reviewer. She originally Nature had that thing for a year and a half. A lot of the reviewers refused to even read it; they just wouldn't. And then when some of them did, they were just like, this is just impossible. Regardless of the data or what's in there, they just said, this isn't possible. It's not possible for this thing to be real under the circumstances that it is. Even though the DNA reflects that it is real, they're matched, aligned with human in some places, but most of it didn't in the nuclear DNA. But all the samples aligned with each other, but they didn't match anything in GenBank. So what's that tell you? It's a new species, right? Because we had over 111 samples that all matched each other.
And were there tissue samples?
Yeah, there was a tissue sample. There's tissue, blood, saliva, lots and lots of hair. I understand where you're looking at me like that and you're coming from. You know, I was involved in this thing since 2009. Over $500,000 was invested into it. They did four major genomes, I think, on them, and I think those were like 10 or 12 grand a piece. They had like 11 labs, did blind testing and cross-checked all the work. They didn't even know what they were testing, but some of them responded back to her after they looked at the DNA and said, what is this? Did you just discover a new species? People have been trying to undercut this thing since the beginning. They don't ever. That's why she had the result of buying her own journal and just putting it out there for the... It depends on how you want to look at it. There was plenty of reviewers that passed it, and there were some that didn't based on reasons that really weren't justified. They just didn't give it a fair shot, really, to be honest with you. You know, I know the samples I sent in were legitimate, you know, and I helped also. I mean, about 40, like I said, I think there's about 40 some samples from this state. But the saliva sample came from Mason County, and then we submitted about 35 hair samples from Grays Harbor that we collected after the saliva sample. We found thousands of hairs. I mean, literally. We ended up with 35 viable samples that were from that area that were hair samples, and they represented a family group of four, I believe. And that was the only family group in the study. They could tell the DNA. They were all related. I think a mother, father, and two siblings. But they lived together, and we found multiple samples of hair from the same individuals over about a nine-month period. The hairs were between 4 inches and 14 inches long, and they looked like human hair, kind of. Diameter was bigger on some of it, though, like double, three times the diameter of human, especially the real long ones. I would like to think that the people that are witnesses and whatnot, like me, that have to deal with this, could be vindicated to some degree and at least have some validation to where actually they, if they do have a problem as related to having sightings of these, or they can't cope with an aspect of it, at least they can go talk to somebody about it and not be looked at like they're nuts. You understand what I'm telling you like that, that there's a certain psychological change that happens in you when something like having a sighting one of these things occurs. I mean, it's a big deal. It is a life-changing event. It's something that you can't really comprehend until it happens to you.
So any chance we could look at those photographs?
Yeah, let me find my laptop.
At my urging, Jermot fired up his laptop to show me the only pictures of Bigfoot his uncounted hours of labor in the backcountry produced. The motion and heat-sensing camera caught many images of wildlife, mainly deer, producing remarkably clear black-and-white images using infrared technology, even at night.
There's a fawn nursing.
And then there it was, or at least there was something smudgy and out of focus right up next to the camera. Jermot helped interpret what I was seeing.
Actually, this is where its elbow is. This is where the deltoid would be, and what you're looking at is a bicep. So you're looking right under the deltoid of it. So
well, as Jermot says, seeing is believing. Now, what I saw that night was not a towering, dark, furry figure gliding through the woods. It was a fuzzy-looking smudge on a computer screen, something that could easily be fudged. But to choose to believe the image on the computer was a hoax was to suspect the earnest young man who invited me into his home to tell his story of intentionally attempting to deceive not only me, but his own family and the rest of the world. Turning that possibility over in my mind, one question kept coming back to me. Why would he? I could find no reasonable answer. As I took my leave that night, Jermot asked me where I lived. I told him, and he ventured a guess. You'll probably pass by three or four families of Bigfoot on your way home, he said. They're all around us all the time. And I have to admit that I looked for dark forms in the shadows from my headlights as I wended my way homeward. This is Steve Evans, wishing you a happy Halloween from KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.